Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. This is It's Hot in Here, and this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host today, Jennifer Johnson, here with an extra special guest host, Rebecca Harden, the ever fabulous champion of the show. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, Sarah. Who, you may ask, is Sarah?
Who is this Sarah?
Who hello. Is this mysterious Sarah who's going to take us today into the land of tea, into Darjeeling, India, and the question of what exactly is fair trade and all that? Sarah's a postdoctoral scholar with the Michigan Society of Fellows and an assistant professor of anthropology and natural resources and environment here at Michigan. And
so many hats.
So many hats to wear over her fabulous hair. Wish you guys could see us in here, but we'll be back soon. We're going to first play a tune.
Yes. Our conversation today may verge on the academic, so we thought we'd take our brows and noses up a notch and listen to a moment of this tune. This is Tea and Crumpets by the Baroque Players.
Oh, how lovely, darling. Well, that tune certainly set a slightly, I don't know, I want to say British colonial mood. Kind of makes me think of the hills of Darjeeling, the plantations over which men in rumpled linen suits once presided. I think we should cut straight to the chase, Sarah. Read us a little bit from your book. Tell us the title of your book.
So the title is The Darjeeling Distinction.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, that's perfect with that music.
The Labor and Justice on Fair Trade Tea Plantations in India. So to set the stage, I'll read the first couple paragraphs of the book.
We're off to Darjeeling, people.
Darjeeling town, perched on one of the highest ridges in the northernmost part of West Bengal, is connected to the rest of India by a rough and bumpy road that begins in the dusty market town of Siliguri. At Siliguri, the railroad from West Bengal's capital, Kolkata, gives way to a narrow-gauge steam locomotive known locally as the Toy Train, which carries tourists up the ridge on a smoky 6-hour journey to Darjeeling. By car, the journey from Siliguri to Darjeeling takes just 3 to 4 hours, traversing through the foggy forests and tea plantations that fall off the road and plummet into the valleys below. Cars zig and zag back and forth up the mountain, weaving in and out of the path of the toy train and passing a few villages, precariously clinging to the sheer hillsides. Dense forests of dupi trees hug the road in a moist evergreen shade. They are planted in military-like formation, perfectly spaced with impeccable posture, their arm-like branches presenting bulbous clumps of needles straight up towards the sky. The drive is mesmerizing, and for many, nauseating, and the landscape is striking. The tea plantations are immediately recognizable. Green and orderly like the dupi, the fields of tea go on for miles, over and around the undulating landscape. But Darjeeling's is a beauty of a manufactured kind, the product of over 100 years of extensive capitalist extraction. The vivid greenness of colonially rooted plantations and dupi forests obscures the acute environmental and social effects of a long history of monoculture and marginalization. Long brown streaks left by landslides on the verdant slopes are reminders of the precariousness of people and plants here. These scars evoke questions about the sustainability of the entire place. This is the landscape of the 21st century plantation.
Wow. I love, if it was hot in here before, now it is steamy. I love that. So I love how you set the stage, as you said, and then instantly back right off your exotic description to say, wait a minute, this isn't all that it seems. That's a great move. I love your, did you really have to think about how to open those first paragraphs? Were they at all wrenching to write?
It was hard. I really wanted to kind of capture this paradox, right? Because, I mean, people go to Darjeeling to see this beauty, to see this greenness. But if you kind of step back and reflect on that greenness, it's that monoculture, that monochromeness has a deep-rooted history. And that and I think I really wanted to, in the first couple pages, really kind of bring you into that paradox and make you sit with that paradox.
What brought you into Darjeeling? How did you find yourself there? Tell us a little bit of the backstory here. I know that you did your PhD at the University of Wisconsin. In fact, confession, I met Sarah years ago in a competitive panel at an American Anthropology Association meeting where she was one of several doctoral candidates who had started writing up the analysis of their data into papers, and we were going to give a prize for the best one. So there they all were, like six of you or something, and each of you was talking about your stuff. And Sarah was just, she just knocked our socks off with her stuff. And so I'm so lucky that we were so happy we got you to get over here to Ann Arbor and join us on this campus. But tell us more about the backstory. How did you get to Darjeeling?
Well, I'm kind of a refugee to Darjeeling in terms of academic life. I mean, I worked in Nepal for years and years, and that's what I went to graduate school to go do. But I was working on the Pashmina industry, you know, those fancy shawls. And I was working with rural goat husbanders. But the civil war in Nepal made it really really hard for me to do work in rural areas. And many other scholars face the same issues. So I wanted to still speak Nepali. I wanted to still work on social justice and commodity chain issues, and that brought me to Darjeeling. I drank tea and I wanted to know more about it. It seemed like a natural fit.
Fantastic.
Staring into your own tea leaves. Mm-hmm. Where will these take me?
Yeah.
To the source.
So how long were you there?
Almost 3 years. So I started my work there just in Darjeeling in 2006. And I finished the last fieldwork stint I did was in 2012. But yeah, between 2006 and 2012, it was about 3 years of work, continuous work.
Wow. That's I think we call that real anthropology. Right? That's real fieldwork.
Long term.
Long term. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about your field study. Like, what was every day you would wake up in the morning and do what exactly?
So I initially started living, I went right into staying on one particular plantation. But then, I found it kind of put villagers into a problematic position vis-a-vis management. And they, you know, just to kind of explain the plantation a little bit, right, a plantation, you know, we may think about it in kind of Euro-American terms as something that's rooted in slavery and that doesn't really exist anymore. It's a thing of the past. But the plantation still really much exists. And what makes a plantation in India or a tea plantation, right, is that the labor force lives there year round, and their parents live there, and their parents' parents live there, and houses, like jobs, are not kind of acquired or bought on a free market. The job and the house are linked together, and, you know, so say, Rebecca, you were my mother, and you were working in the tea field, and it came time for you to retire, you would pass your job to me. That job wasn't necessarily something that went to anyone else. It is something that is directly inherited. It's not an industrial, you know, site like we might see it. So living in these villages kind of made me realize that it made workers, you know, very visible to management. So after about 6 months on one particular plantation, I took a apartment, a little room in town right on the ridge of Darjeeling. And every day I would hike down.
What is town like? What's Darjeeling town like? Tell me. I want to know. I'm married to a guy who went to school in Darjeeling, to boarding school. So it's a place with a lot of, right? He's Indian and he went to school, and a lot of his nieces and nephews have gone to these schools in Darjeeling. I don't know why there are so many schools there.
So, I mean, the geography is quite striking. So Darjeeling Town, when I say Darjeeling Town, really is a ridge that kind of pops up. It's on the highest foothill in the region. And those schools are quite remarkable on either side of the ridge. So imagine kind of a crescent-shaped ridge, you know, on the top of a foothill. On either side of the ridge, so kind of on either point, are the two old major schools, the old British schools, and they kind of face each other in this kind of dialogue set off by the Kanchenjunga kind of range. Village. And in between those two schools, that's where kind of the old colonial town is. And everything kind of essentially on the backfill from making and flattening that ridge for colonial occupation, that's where Nepalese and workers and people who staffed those colonial bungalows and staffed the restaurants and staffed the hotels and the holiday homes, that's where they lived. So there's this very stark uptown, downtown, or, you know, the actual altitude of Darjeeling is there's a stratigraphy of mountain and class.
Like a lot of places, really. Although it's also kind of probably pretty intimate. You were saying you could walk from one place to the other. And I mean, I think of it, I contrast it with, I've been so fascinated lately by the kind of reimagining of plantations in dystopic popular culture, like a film like The Hunger Games, where you have an entire separate district that's about like plantation and orchard agriculture in that set of films and books. And again, families, like you said, working together. So there's elements of what you're describing that get recreated in these popular narratives right now.
The film 12 Years a Slave,
yes,
really recently.
Yes, right. It's like we're almost coming back around to an aesthetics of food production and food security in our popular culture that's so interesting. And it draws on these very real settings in a way that kind of forecasts them or casts them into the future. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about the present. And so let's get back to you walking down the hill from your apartment. Then what?
I mean, that walk could take anywhere between, you know, an hour and a half and 4 hours, just down into these plantations, right? Because from that ridge, all the plantations kind of sweep off from there. So from that ridge, you can see both the mountains and the valleys, which are those green kind of verdant slopes. And so I would go meet labor groups. Women work every day in the same group of laborers, you know, day to day, season to season. That's that group. And so I would follow a group around and pick tea with them. And
working with women. That's cool. I'm reminded of the incredible colonial erotics of tea and coffee and women and white men. Mm-hmm. Serge Gainsbourg comes to mind. Anybody ever seen those crazy 60s videos of him with these dancing girls? It makes you glad you live now. I will say that. But let's take a listen to Serge singing Couleur Café. I love your café color. I love your café legs. I love your café. It's unbelievable. It's in French. Heads up. But it's amazing.
J'aime ta couleur café, tes cheveux café, ta gorge café. J'aime quand pour moi tu danses, alors j'entends murmurer tous tes bracelets, jolis bracelets. À tes pieds ils se balancent. C'est quand même fou l'effet que ça fait de te voir rouler ainsi des yeux et des hanches. Si tu fais comme le café, rien qu'à m'énerver, rien qu'à m'exciter, ce soir la nuit sera blanche. Sans philosopher, c'est comme le café, très vite passé. Mais que veux-tu que j'y fasse? On en a marre de café, et c'est terminé. Pour tout oublier, on attend que ça se tasse.
Wow. Well, we will post a link to that tune and the video on our website, hotinhere.us. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and this is It's Hot in Here. And we are here with Sarah Besky, author of the newly published book, The Darjeeling Distinction, Labor and Justice on a Fair Trade Tea Plantations in India.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah. So we're back. We're in Darjeeling.
And what is that Darjeeling distinction exactly? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, there's so many valences. But to talk about the tea itself, I mean, Darjeeling tea is one of those, is one of the few teas, particularly within India, that's drunk without milk or sugar. And it's kind of part of its value that it has this lightness. It has its innate flavor. Hmm. So there's tons of other tea growing regions in India. To the northeast, there's Assam, which you may have heard of, or in South India, but those teas are generally they're darker, they're more tannic. They're produced. There's two varieties of bush. There's the China variety, which was stolen in the 1850s again by British colonial administrators and
stashed in a rucksack
planted clandestinely in the foothills of Darjeeling and Assam. But there's also an indigenous variety, the Assam variety, which is the leaves are glossier and bigger, but they make a blacker, more tannic tea. And a myth or reality, but what makes Darjeeling special is that it's supposed to be mostly China variety bush, not the indigenous bush. So this exotic, and that's not really true. They have some
Mythbusters. WCBN.
But some of the higher altitudes, you know, the China bush does grow better. But I mean, because it's such a stark kind of the fields can go from 4,000 feet to 2,000 feet, you know, the same plantation. So those 2,000 feet plantings need to be the Assam. It's too hot down there. It is hot in there for those bushes. It is. The geography necessitates both kinds of bushes, but there's this idea that it's just that Chinese variety, which is lighter and more delicate, just like the people who pluck it, right? So what makes Darjeeling different, in a kind of colonial sense, was that there were Nepali laborers staffed the bungalows, sat the children, and you know, brought you tea, you brought you bed tea, but they also worked the plantations. And in a racialization of labor across South Asia, Nepalis kind of fit into these service categories. They were also very good soldiers, right? So you may have heard of the Gurkha regiments as well.
Sure, sure. Right. Wow. I'm also reminded of categories within Nepali labor, like Vinkan Adams' book, Tigers of the Snow, Virtual Sherpas, like talking about who does the trekking labor and who doesn't. Really, yeah, those are, and I wonder if those categories are kind of a historical artifact, an anachronism now, or do you still see Darjeeling as an appealing tourist destination? And do you still see, what does the plantation labor look like today?
Oh, I mean, it is. I mean, it's becoming an even more popular tourist destination for both international and domestic tourists. But for international tourists, right, it's kind of this reliving of the Raj that is being sold. So for $400 and $500 a night, you can go stay in an old planter's bungalow and go for butterfly hunts and picnics by the river and have a Nepali guide escort you through for a walk. But that is being sold every day in Darjeeling. And on a lot of the plantations I worked on, fair trade or conventional or whatever, right, being able to see these owners or these planters, you know, decked out in these Raj era kind of colonial safari suits and, you know, presiding over labor as you know, on their horse, you know, there are these really stark images of kind of what you would think of as a bygone era, but are being kind of reappropriated for contemporary consumption, particularly for the international market.
Paula Deen comes to mind.
Yeah,
right now.
Yeah.
Wow. So, but you're working less on the touristic and more on the actual kind of labor practices and the organization. Am I right? Like, tell me more about. We talked before the music break about you walking down the hill and meeting with people day to day in your work, and largely with women, right? So, what are these women doing? Like, how does that work? What's the plantation feel like? What's it do?
It has this kind of remarkable expansiveness because so unlike like a coffee or a cane, you know, as a plant that you kind of take down every year to harvest, right? Mm-hmm. Tea is cultivated. So every day you pluck the newest shoots of leaves off a bush and you go to the next bush and you go to the next bush. And then a week later, you're coming back to that same bush. There's this kind of constant manipulation, this constant cultivation of the landscape and you know, these little minute it leaves, you know, kind of constantly kind of looking for the newest, softest little sprigs, as opposed to, you know, and there's anthropologists like Sidney Mintz, who in his work on the cane has just these evocative descriptions of taking down the cane as this aggressive, you know, violent, you know, process that hurts. It has this visceral pain to it. And I like to kind of contrast that to tea plucking, which is kind of this constant cultivation, this constant rearing. And women I worked with talked about these new bushes as children, as particularly non-gendered children. They use the word nani, right? Like pukka nani are real children, and not men children or women children. But when these bushes became old, right? And what's really interesting is that a tea bush has about the productive life of a human being, right? 75 so years. After that, they become impotent. They become old. They become buro,
wow.
Right? Which is the word you would use, like, kind of to scold your husband. But it also is that old man.
Can you spell that for me? No, I'm kidding. I think we might need to cut to a little romantic music at this.
Yes,
point,
yes.
That's not going in the right direction. We could all get in trouble for the way this is going. I think. What do we have up next, Jeff?
Next is Frank Sinatra. When I Take My Sugar to Tea.
Hello.
Which is a fun little tune.
Old blue eyes.
We'll be coming back talking about some property issues as well. It's interesting to listen to this with an ear towards thinking about property and exclusivity. Perhaps.
Okay. Fantastic.
Take it away, Mr. Blue.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me, 'cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea. I'm a rowdy dowdy, that's me. She's a hi-hat baby, that's she. So I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea. Every Sunday afternoon we forget about our cares, rubbing elbows at the Ritz with those millionaires. When I take my sugar to tea, I'm as ritzy as I can be, 'cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea. Every Sunday afternoon we forget about those cares, rubbing elbows at the Ritz with those zillionaires. When I take my sugar to tea, I'm as ritzy as I can be, 'cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
Yeah, that's right. Frank does not want all of his friends seeing his lady when he takes his sugar for tea. Little exclusion there. But a sensible practice, perhaps, if his lady is particularly hot. This is It's Hot in Here. We're here with Sarah Besky.
But don't put sugar in your Darjeeling tea.
No.
People. Oh, you'd ruin the Darjeeling distinction?
You would.
Oh,
my
goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, so what about how we were just drawing you out on the care and work that goes into getting the best leaves off these bushes and how long they live? And it's really amazing. I'm just wondering what the actual breakdown is of plantation service area and how the land rights work behind all this stuff, and who gets what revenue flow, and like, how does the property stuff work with these plantations?
So yeah, I talk about kind of two instances of property, but the actual kind of like plantation property, tea plantations in particular are really fascinating because they have quote unquote plantation owners, but those plantations aren't really owned. They're really owned by the state governments, right? And they're leased by plantation owners.
Were they former crown land? I'm saying crown land, harkening back to the colonial time, and that was sort of
British.
So they were issued by the colonial government on 99-year leases to settlers to develop the plantation land. Most of Darjeeling was classified as wasteland, so it was just kind of given up for free
because of the altitude and the mountains, or what?
Actually, mostly because it wasn't really administered by any colonial government. It was kind of this hinterland, and so it was really administered by the kind of colonial magistrate in power, like in Darjeeling. Not necessarily, it didn't until much later in kind of colonial history kind of fall under the kind of the Bengal as a polity. So it was wasteland. It was easy to make, it was easy to kind of form a tea plantation, and those leases still kind of hold on. So now they're issued on 33-year leases, but plantations are all still owned kind of by the state, this like weird kind of, you know, if you will, like private public partnership and
concession.
And workers are really aware of this, that the state really owns that plantation. And it's that kind of the fact that the state doesn't give back to them through taxes, particularly that is vexing. Right. So for workers the plantation owners are all, they're non-Nepalis, they're all extra local, that, you know, this idea that they didn't grow up there, they have no kind of ties to place, and that they're kind of this idea of quote unquote paying taxes to themselves is problematic. So one of the, and this is maybe kind of foreshadowing the discussion later on, but one of the reasons to set up a separate state within Gorkhaland, to break Darjeeling plantations off as a separate state called Gorkhaland, Gorkhas being Indian Nepalis, what kind of they as a group moniker, is to be able to own that land under tea. It's like to have that land under tea be Gorkha land, and that's that is particularly evocative for workers. But
wait, can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. When did it? Do you know when it went from 99 years to 33 years?
It wasn't like a clean break. So some are still on 99-year leases, but all new leases are 33-year leases now. There were a few that were issued as 99-year leases. I talked to land reforms department people, and there just wasn't a clean break. Sometimes you had a 99-year lease grandfathered in if it was, say, the same company that was controlling it somehow from colonial times to the present.
Okay. Interesting. So there's that frustration with tax revenues and services, because are they getting mostly, you know, the, like, who's building schools and clinics in this kind of a system? Like, who's doing that kind of service provision? Is it the plantation owners, or is it the state, or how does that work?
So the schools are provided by the state government. Everything else, roads, nurseries, medical facilities, housing, water supply, all of that basic infrastructure is supposed to be provided by the tea company, and that is written out in Indian labor law. So workers on plantations get a artificially low wage because, I mean, almost half the daily minimum wage because of these in-kind payments that they're supposed to receive. And so, but often plantations skimp on those in-kind payments. Like, the roads aren't being rebuilt after a landslide. If you can imagine, landslides happen quite frequently. They take out houses, they take out nurseries, they take out roads most of the time, and they're not getting rebuilt, and that so workers say, you know, if you're not going to do this stuff that you're supposed to do, you know, these what they call facilities, then pay us that minimum wage, which is, like, you know, at this point, like, over 120 rupees a day, and a lot of the time during my field work, workers were getting 53 rupees a day, which is, you know, just over a dollar, you know, just about a dollar a day. So 53 rupees was at the time about a dollar a day.
How does this compare with the rest of India in terms of state provision of services for in places where people are working? So, okay, the state's responsible for schools, but
it just ends there.
So it's a little bit it's a little bit different because this kind of Plantations Labor Act kind of trumps a lot of other or is just seen to trump a lot of other kind of government facilities. Mm-hmm. The burden again in a very kind of colonial sense that this paternalist system, the owner is supposed to kind of provide all those things, and the owner can apply for various grants from this state institution or this state institution to build up that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But it is still the owner's responsibility to provide for that plantation. And that is all under the Indian labor law.
So the kind of transmission of this across generations, both from, you were saying earlier, a lot of the labor is women. Mm-hmm. They're not using chainsaws or machetes to cut down trees or cane. Mm-hmm. This is very fine work. So skilled, almost hand fine, mm-hmm. Picking these leaves and cultivating these plants. And so you were saying often it's, mother to child or grandmother even to grandchild, mm-hmm. the labor, which I guess sort of props up these property arrangements, right? Because there's a sense in which the jobs themselves are the property of particular families, mm-hmm. and then they're not breaking out to go find more favorable conditions. Or, how would you describe the kind of ups and downs of that sense of, culture? The culture of this labor, this gendered intergenerational thing that's going on. And it sounds like it includes maybe even, entire families who've been working for particular plantation owners for generations. Mm-hmm. Like, that's hard to break out of, right? Or
it is really hard to break out of, but honestly, in Darjeeling, there's nothing to break out to. One of the critiques, that workers express is that there is no development in Darjeeling. Nothing, all this timber, tea, resources kind of flow down the mountain, but nothing ever comes back up. No money ever comes back up. So there's just, mm-hmm. there's not a lot of opportunities. If you do have a class 10 education, if you do have, if you live somewhere else, say you would, be able to perhaps get a government job, and those government jobs are really, really rare in Darjeeling.
Those two schools you set up, mm-hmm. In the landscape, are they being, are students going there whose parents perhaps have worked in these plantations?
No.
It's all outsiders. Those are the private schools.
Uh-huh.
Those mm-hmm. are the boarding schools that date from the Hill Colony schools that date from, right?
Or? Right. Right. No. So tea laborers' children are not going to those two fancy schools. The schools you can't see, mm-hmm. those perhaps if they do go to school, those are the ones that they will go to. Still, often, underwritten by the Catholic Church in some way. But mm-hmm. Those are for extra, generally fancy people.
So there's like the rich Darjeeling, mm-hmm. and the working Darjeeling, and
right.
these are really big distinctions, which kind of call to mind just this whole economic issue. Or I think our next tune on the docket is one that deals with money and the idea of what's it called, the price of a cup of tea.
That's right.
It's a Belle and Sebastian tune.
Yeah, a variety of things that they will offer for a price of a cup of tea.
Beautiful.
You got a line of cover for the price of a night with me. You'd be the village Joe for the price of a pint of milk. I'll tell you all I know about this. Sit down, enjoy the show. She just wants to be to the
WCBN-FM 88.3 Ann Arbor. Rebecca Harden here with Jennifer Johnson. It is hot in here, and that is partly because the very, very hot-to-trot Sarah Besky is talking to us about tea production and about the sort of really interesting stories under the surface of that Darjeeling distinction tea we see from the hill plantations in India. I have to say, Sarah, I know personally undergraduates who have like waited for each other in dark alleys with extremely infectious viral agents to try to compromise each other's health and get each other off your wait lists for your classes that are teaching on this campus about, you know, what is fair, what is unfair, what is fair trade, what kinds of food production questions do we need to be asking for the 21st century? And I know that there's just a lot going on with those issues. I wonder if you could maybe read us a little bit from your book, The Darjeeling Distinction, about this question of fair trade and loans and all that stuff.
I would love to, and maybe we can, it'll pose a little bit of a question. It won't resolve anything for sure. Prakriti and I were crouched down, hovering above the dirt floor of her kitchen, chatting about upcoming weddings on the plantation. She was concerned about what color kurta I should wear. I wore too much green. And how much I might possibly control my wiry, ghost-like hair for the occasions. As she got up to get us more tea, milky, sugary chia, made from her monthly ration of dust-grayed leaf, the tethered cow in the shed attached to her kitchen let out a long, aggravated moo that vibrated the brittle bamboo walls. "What do you do with that cow anyway?" I asked her. I had had tea at Prakriti's house many times, and I'd never seen that cow outside the shed. Despite her popularity in development products on Darjeeling plantations, cows were ill-suited for the plantation landscape. Not only would it be difficult for a cow to navigate through the densely planted tea bushes, plantation owners prohibited cows from grazing on plantations. Thus, cows were confined to small sheds in plantation villages and a life of alternately sitting and standing. Prakriti's cow stayed in that shed all day, munching on bamboo leaves. "Oh, that cow," she said. "Years ago, I got it from a fair trade loan from the company. We thought that we could sell the milk and the calves up in town. The manager said that the company would buy back the dung for organics." "So you don't sell those things?" I asked. "When do I have time?" she said, exasperated, pouring steaming chia into our glasses from a dented aluminum pot. "So what if I have that cow?" she pointed towards the shed. "We are all poor here. I give the milk to my sister and brother." And she paused and turned in the animal's direction. "She cannot graze anywhere. The legs of that cow are like my life, absolutely weak."
Wow.
Man. I mean, I guess that's as much of an indictment of the very good intentions of fair trade as anything I've heard lately. And it's very, very real. It's frustrating, I guess, on many levels, because, I mean, what would you say? I mean, what do you say to your students and your colleagues and the many fair trade organizations that know your work and use your work? I mean, are we heading in the right direction? I mean, is this something that has imperfections and ironies like that, but that needs to keep getting better? Or do you think there might be really alternative approaches to making this kind of labor a little bit less oppressive?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I want to do, you know, whether it's for my students or when I talk to fair trade standards officers, is to just constantly come back to context, to come back to asking, you know, having them ask themselves, what is the plantation, right? Like thinking about the actual landscape, thinking like a cow sounds great. A loan for a cow sounds wonderful. Yeah. Selling the milk up in town, that's wonderful. Great.
And the dung, and it's going to be amazing.
How does that cow move through the landscape? Like where is there space for a cow on this overcrowded plantation? Like the actual kind of practical, implications of, you know, such development initiatives, right? And so, the cow just kind of being this paradigmatic, or this imagery of kind of development initiatives right now that I see, whether it be, you know, through kind of Heifer International or Fair Trade,
right?
That there's this you know, evocativeness of livestock, right? This maybe charismatic microfauna, or if you will, or, you know.
I love it.
Right? Like, they're not quite mega, like somewhat megafauna. For my students in particular, you know, it's really hard to critique something that is supposed to be good, or something that is, you know, something that has some sort of valences, of some positive valences.
Or is otherwise the alternative to the bad.
Right.
Set up
but,
that way.
But, I mean, what I mean, what social justice is, or like how, you know, to understand kind of social justice is always about kind of framing injustice, right? And we have to kind of understand the injustice, right? We have to really kind of understand what injustice is and what it means to the people themselves, right? The kind of subjects of this injustice before, you know, implementing any kind of so quote unquote social justice initiatives, from cows to, you know, whatever development project it may be.
Well, and something that is on the face of it an alternative to problematic practices can become a complement to them, or as people have said of anthropology itself, a handmaiden, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's, and that set of issues has a lot to do with the unintended consequences of acts. And it puts us all in a really complicated position where we have to really think about both our intended actions and their consequences and what happens that we can never control, and mm-hmm. that then can, you know, but we have to watch, and someone has to help us think through. And I think your work is doing an amazing job on that. It cannot always be easy. I mean, have you had moments where you felt like, okay, I can't do this, or it's too hard, or...
Right. I mean, or like, what is it that I'm doing? I mean, if I'm just kind of like pointing, or, you know, just, or am I just kind of pointing at when things don't work, and is that productive? Right. Or, but to try to find some sort of prescription, or to try to find some, you know, some sort of like, well, what can we do? And I keep coming back to, you know, what I mentioned about context, like to really, you know, what I see my role is, and what I, you know, in teaching and in my activist work, or my kind of, you know, my work with fair trade, you know, certifiers, is to think with the plantation, to think about what it
right.
is and what it means, and how it means differently in the U.S. or in, you know, Latin America or in India. Right.
In Uganda, a banana plantation is just anywhere where bananas are growing, and other crops right. are described as gardens.
Right. And, you
well,
know,
and where I work in the Congo Basin, everyone's running scared in front of the idea that standing forests in general are going to give way to palm oil plantations and the new kind of biofuels era, right? So there's this whole, the plantation itself is becoming an eco menace, but also part of the eco solution in this weird way that, so I mean, thinking with the plantation is so, it's so interesting to me right now, the way that you're doing that, and the way that then you have this question of fairness on top. That transnational stuff, I think, reminds me of this Michelle Ndege Ocello song, which is called God Shiva, off of her, it's not off of Plantation Lullabies, it's actually off of her, I think it's off of her Peace Beyond Passion album, and it's a Hindu-inspired tune that's got a very Afro-Caribbean groove to it. Let's give it a listen for a minute while we come back and talk about sovereignty.
Transcendent reality.
Michelle Ndege Ochella. We are so glad Madonna discovered you. This is WCBN FM 88.3 Ann Arbor, and it is hot in here. We've gotten hotter talking about the real problems with what do we do as consumers and people. I was talking earlier about students literally tripping each other and causing injuries to get off the wait list and into Sarah's classes because everybody's all tied up in knots about, look, does it matter if I drink fair trade tea? And what choices should I make? And what will it make a difference if I make these choices? And what do you have to offer us, Sarah? Like, how do we work this out? What's your thinking?
It's hard because there's no easy answer. That's kind of one of my mantras is there's no easy answer. But what's kind of fascinating is to kind of think maybe we can, you know, think about moral economies for a minute, right? And with the fair trade moral economy or what my students and what all of us want to do is think about the relationship that we as consumers have to the people that produce the things that we make, right? So that, but what I want to bring attention to is, well, what are then, so if that's a relationship, then what then are the relationships that constitute the plantation itself, right? And so in the book, I develop this idea of what's called the tripartite moral economy. And a classic...
Yeah, please, getting into it.
Okay. I was like, a classic moral economy, right, is a binary relationship, a two-way relationship between patron and client or plantation owner or landlord and the workers themselves, right?
And when we're thinking moral economy, we're thinking economic relationships that aren't just simply dollars and cents. There are other things being exchanged, other kinds of obligations and relationships.
Absolutely, right? And it's really the actual money that's not necessarily important. In the case of the plantation, the provision of roads, the provision of houses, and in turn, right, workers care for the bushes. They pluck the leaves that they're supposed to, right? Mm-hmm. And moral economies, I think, importantly, are they regulate exploitation, right? They're kind of a picture of exploitation, right?
They justify it too,
mm-hmm. right? I mean, as opposed to like, and so what? So the moral economy kind of paints a picture of what under what conditions can people suffer just enough before they revolt, right?
And so this is like Chayanov classic peasant studies. Absolutely. This is old school social theory, but now it meets new economies of consumption and new generations that are like, wait, we don't want the world to work that old way, but what's the option?
We don't want a steaming cup of exploitation in the morning.
Thank you.
As I pour some coffee.
I was trying to look away.
Fairly traded from Uganda.
I was trying to look away from you.
Coffee Hills.
But I mean, but if we think, academicians have used that, you know, moral economic concept to kind of think about the relationship that consumers have to the people who produce the things that they make, fair trade or not, as a moral economic relationship, right? What are the obligations that, you know, we have as consumers, or what are the felt, you know, obligations we sense as consumers that we have to do for the downtrodden in the third world, right? That smiling small farmer that is embossed on our fair trade tea packet, right? Mm. What is the relationship there? And is that a relationship, or is that kind of a fetish of a relationship that is being sold to us? Or some sort of idea that's perpetuated that we need to think about that as something that informs our consumption. And there's no clear answer, but it's that I think what I want to bring my students to in particular is to think about that as that's a marketing message. It's not, I mean, as much as it is a real, perhaps a perceived relationship.
Right.
Yeah, I've had conversations. It's like you spend that extra, whatever, 30 mm-hmm. cents or depending on whatever product it is you're buying just to make yourself feel better. You feel like that a lot of times, which...
Even if on the ground, the difference between a conventional tea plantation and a fair trade tea plantation isn't all that yet or... May never be. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's the thing, right?
Well, to think about that extra, say, 30 cents that you spent on that fair trade product, right? That's actually kind of part of fair trade economics, right? There's two kind of quantitative values that are associated with fair trade. The first is that there's a minimum price, right? And so this idea that fair trade challenges neoliberal economics in which there's a price set outside of the free market for the goods. So like a pound of Ugandan coffee is going to sell at this price. A fair trade Ugandan coffee is going to sell at this price, no matter what happens to the market. The second is that there's a premium, and that's a little extra bit of money that's attached to the price of the thing itself. And that that money, that little like extra bit, that little lanyap, travels to a joint a bank account somewhere in my case in Darjeeling, India, which is held jointly by owners and management. And so how fair, I think one of the starkest differences in how fair trade operates differently on plantations and cooperatives is that on cooperatives, that little extra bit of money, if you'd like to think about it that way, that premium is distributed throughout the cooperative or somehow decided on to do something with it, to build something, to do something with it. But on a plantation, there is a body, an elected body that kind of decides what to do with that premium. And the person who generally presides over the body is the plantation owner. Mm-hmm. And the second, the vice president or the kind of the other, a lot of the other members of that joint body are management, right? So the male figures on a lot of these joint bodies are management and the female figures are workers. And right, in this body, right, this is the idea of fair trade, is that it's supposed to somehow jointly decide what to do with fair trade revenue. And that through, by the virtue of a plantation being fair trade, this relationship is supposed to work, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, the contrast, right, being is that the very idea of the moral economy is that the relationships between patron and client or landlord and worker are unequal, right? And so fair trade really doesn't really acknowledge this, and just to kind of put people together in this body tries to, you know, make them equal, and they will never be equal.
And you pointed to these debates in your book about when the possibilities of certifying plantation agricultural commodity production itself as fair trade that circulated.
Well, that and also environmental, like organic and other kinds of metrics by which things get certified and which may sort of muddy the waters in terms of which metrics are we applying and which kinds of certifications are we seeking. I mean, I wonder what the future of all that looks like in terms of accountability for certification schemes in these contexts.
Right. And it's really, I mean, as I mentioned earlier in the show, I spent 3 years in Darjeeling and I saw very, very little actual certification, like actual auditing. And a lot of it is done, the same individual is certifying for three different certification schemes with three different clipboards. And there's just, it's really difficult. A lot of, there's just, I think it's a structural issue. There's not a lot of attention. There's not a lot of money kind of put into the auditing of plantations or of anything I know about plantations. And that is something that really needs to be addressed. Like that auditing needs to be perhaps more serious. It needs to be more frequent, and it needs, you know, and perhaps boxes and the checking or the metrics maybe aren't something that should be the focus, right? Maybe more qualitative measures, maybe you know, and to think about you know, going beyond the village that kind of surrounds the plantation owner's house or the factory, and to think about how the perceptions of inequality between those villages and the villages and on the outside of the plantation, right? Those are things that really need to be considered.
Oh my gosh, I think to even think straight about it, I might need a cup of coffee. can we listen to a little Java Jive while we think through these qualitative criteria? Because that's complicated, man. Let's get some coffee.
I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, Mr. Mortal, I'm a coffee pot. Shoot me the ball.
aubergine greens. Now I don't care about a bean, unless it is the chili, chili bean boy.
Sarah, this just in, Sarah Besky says don't drink tea bags.
Really?
I mean, not the actual bags. The tea inside the bags, turns out, are just basically floor scraps.
Really?
That, I mean, that's... So if you think, I don't know if you've ever had a can of mixed nuts, right? So if you shake a can of mixed nuts, the big Brazil nuts go to the top and the peanuts go to the bottom. Uh-huh. That's what happens to tea, and it's, you know, after it's kind of first withered and dried and fired and rolled, it goes into a sorting machine that shakes it. Right. And all the little pieces go to the bottom, and all the big pieces, those fine, beautiful twists of tea, go to the top.
That are retailing for like $500 a kilo,
yes,
or something. Just
yes.
Wild.
Yes.
Are you kidding? The Darjeeling leaves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The fanciest of the fancy, particularly from the first, there's four flushes of Darjeeling tea. The first flush being in March. Right. And so the after the kind of period of winter dormancy, these like first fresh shoots, little of leaves in the cold weather. Right. Those are the first flush leaves. And some of that, yes, the top of the Brazil nuts of that go for upwards of $500 a kilogram. And connoisseurs from across the world come straight to the plantations, right, in March to come get those.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, so here you have this luxury product, right? And you've mm-hmm. talked to us all day today about the Darjeeling distinction, but it turns out it's not just about the luxury product, right? Darjeeling as a place is distinct. Mm-hmm. And, I mean... on all these levels, and including as a place within India, which is kind of contested and has some movements within it for independence and very, very tricky issues here.
Right, right. I mean, like, and that's, I mean, that kind of complexity is really what I want to kind of do with the book and kind of move you through all of the ways in which Darjeeling is valued or thought to be distinguished, right? As first as a place, right? This mountainside retreat, this place where British soldiers used to go convalesce, you know, when they had malaria, all the way to that,
bless,
you know,
their hearts.
Yeah.
Well, have their bed tea.
Well,
apparently.
Keep their children and their wives, right, up in the clean mountain airs. You know, to something that can sit alongside, right? Darjeeling is a geographical indication, something that can sit alongside Champagne and Roquefort and cognac. To something that and workers are now starting. I mean, they realize that Darjeeling is something different. They realize that Darjeeling is something that is more expensive than adjacent regions of tea, and that is becoming part of the rhetoric of the movement to kind of break Darjeeling off and become its own state.
Well, may we drink to the idea that the good life, to set up our next track, the good life cocoa tea be more available to those workers and be better thought about by those of us who are on the consumption end of it. Sarah, thank you for sharing this with us and for giving us your special tips and tricks.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should say there are links to more information about Sarah's book on our website, hotinhere.us. I really recommend that y'all go out and get a copy. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the radio, but she brings a lot of complicated ideas and really takes you in.
Beautiful
to
book.
Darjeeling.
Beautiful woman.
Yeah,
beautiful
riveting.
Book. Let's
love it.
Let's go out with a good life.
Well, thank
let's
you so
do it.
Much.
This has been It's Hot in Here. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Special thanks to our engineer, Gus Turner, for keeping us on and pushing all the buttons so wonderfully. We'll see you next week.
She say she want a good life, no one to cause her pain and stripes. She want a good life, no man to cause her pain and strife.